Hello everyone and welcome to The Time Is Now, Soylent Green Is People. My name is Kurt North and welcome back to another installment of Millennium Season 3. And to join me on the podcast today is returning guest after venturing in through the end of the world and coming out the other side is Darren Mooney. Darren, how are things doing today and how are you finding yourself after that apocalypse that you ended up in last year?
Well, I mean, it's kind of amazing. I think it's great that, you know, we've learned from this episode that we're going to discuss right now that cinema can indeed survive the end of the world. I think it's a very heartening message, particularly in these very, very troubling times. I think it's very timely. I think nobody really appreciates how much 13 years later speaks to us. To be honest, at this stage, 22 years later. So I'm thrilled to be here, Kurt. Thrilled to be here.
Excellent. And we're just coming off the back of, you know, our own little apocalypse in the world at the moment. As we've talked right through season two as well. And I know this will date the podcast, you know, for those children who are living in, you know, the 2040s and listening back to a show.
Everything is a time capsule. 2000.
Exactly. Today's a special day at the time of recording. Cinema is back. Tenet has just been released today and, you know, that's been quite a few weeks since anything's been on the cinema screen. I know that you've seen it a couple of times with press screenings and stuff, and I saw it this morning. So how do you think the state of cinema is at the moment? Anyway, just before we jump into the episode.
Well, I think everybody's kind of worried. I mean, obviously and understandably, because of the situation that we're in, everybody's nervous about going back to cinemas, and understandably so. And even when they go back, you have kind of restrictions on how many people you can accommodate in a cinema. I mean, you work at a place that includes a cinema, so you know all this yourself.
I do.
So like the financial pressures on cinemas, which were quite tight to begin with. I mean, even in the States, I think AMC and Regal were very much kind of on the edge of bankruptcy before this came into effect. So I think that it is, you know, cinemas maybe hasn't been in the healthiest place for a little while, and this has pushed it a little bit beyond. Now, obviously, there are far more serious things happening as a result of the pandemic, far more important things to worry about for people who are listening as well. So I don't want to kind of harp on too much about it. But yeah, I as somebody who really likes films and as somebody who reviews films and somebody who, you know, has many cherished memories of going to the cinema, one of the, you know, and again, very difficult times in very serious ways. And I don't mean to downplay that. And I don't mean to make it sound like, you know, I also didn't see my parents for like 4 or 5 months. So I'm hesitant when I say that, you know, I really miss the cinema, but I did really miss the cinema, to be absolutely honest. And obviously not the most important thing in the world, but it did feel strange not to be going. And I've been very, very lucky that I've been able to attend a couple of screenings of Tenet. Because Ireland has been in a situation where it is, and again, this is a very important and weight-bearing word, so relatively successful in containing the pandemic, at least compared to some of our neighbours. We have been able to reopen cinemas for quite a while, so I've been able to attend a couple of screenings very cautiously and very timidly. And going to those, it was remarkable because it underscored how much I missed that, how different it felt, you know, sort of how odd it felt being back in that space since I think the 8th of March was the last time I was in a cinema before this began. So it was kind of just great to be back there. And, you know, again, I've written a book on Christopher Nolan. I am a huge fan of Christopher Nolan. So it's probably going to be no surprise to absolutely anybody listening that I really, really enjoyed Tenet. And I really enjoyed Tenet. I know, shocker, stop the press here. But I really enjoyed Tenet as an example of the blockbuster cinematic experience, as something that was big and spectacle filled and something that was fun to see. First of all, with an audience of people obviously safely socially distanced, wearing masks, washing their hands, to be absolutely clear, but seeing it with an audience of people who are having the same reaction that I was. But more intimately than that, seeing it with a friend who came out of it and was like, I immediately need to talk about this with somebody. And kind of having that kind of intense experience that you only really get when you watch a movie with other people or with somebody else. So yeah, I was absolutely thrilled, and it was good to be back. Now, I imagine I won't be going to the cinema as regularly as I used to go, because obviously the situation that we're in, but yeah, it's different, and it's kind of good to be able to do that. Although I understand that for some people listening as you release this, that probably won't be an option, and I completely understand that. And for other people listening, that won't be a priority, and I also completely understand that. But yes, personally, I was very glad to get the chance to go and see Tenet in the cinema a couple of times.
Yeah. Well, surprise, surprise, this episode's going out on Halloween. So we may well be eating our words depending on where we are at that position. I actually went this morning, and I didn't intend to go with anyone, but I found out that my girlfriend's sister's husband was actually got tickets as well.
Oh.
So because we have to have allocated seating, and we were told not to get out of those allocated seating, he was on the opposite side of the cinema to me. But it was one of those things where straight afterwards was like, right, find out what's going on.
Yeah.
But it's a bit of return to normality, really. And it's just nice, as you say, it's there's a lot more bigger fish to fry. I mean, you mentioned I've got a cinema, and which I do, but our site isn't going to be opening until, probably after this airs. So we're talking after Halloween. So we should be at this point making preparations, hopefully, to open. But it was nice just to be able to do something a bit normal. During the pandemic, I actually went to get my mother's prescription in the middle of the city, and I felt really strange. Even though I've worked throughout the pandemic, it was always something I knew and it was trusted, and I know my home, I know my work.
Yeah.
And going into town was difficult. It was like, oh, I didn't like this. Whereas today, the cinema experience actually was okay. We're obviously at a different stage of where we were, 3 months ago.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But, I've been in town in Ireland a couple of times, in Dublin, and it is different now than it was even a couple of weeks ago. I remember being in town for something a couple of weeks ago, work related. And it was literally just all the restaurants and outside, again, almost like something out of a nature documentary. You had all the bike couriers for like the Deliveroo apps and places like that, just waiting to take orders from these restaurants and deliver them to people. It was a very strange experience. It was a completely alien place. But when I was back in last week and this week to see press screenings of Tenet, it was much more. Life has returned to normal, but obviously with masks and with a bit more consciousness about distance and stuff. So it's interesting how people are adjusting. And obviously we're going to have to wait and see what the figures are like. Listeners listening to this in the future, we are communicating with the future, Kurt. Listening to this in the future will probably have a better idea of how this actually went. But it does feel like people are managing or adjusting or compensating in ways that are perhaps heartening in some ways, or at least my experience of it here in a very particular country, in a very particular set of circumstances, and not at all a universal experience. But what I've seen kind of does give me a little bit of hope in terms of people coping with something like this.
Yeah, well, if there's any issues, what I'll do is I'll go back in the past and re-edit this and it'll be fine. It'll be all good. This week is 13 years later, which was the episode. Which episode are we on? 1, 2, 3, 4.
5.
Episode 5 of season 3. And this is your first appearance on season 3. I know we discussed season 3 a little bit at length at the end of season 2. But 5 episodes in now, we've gone through the Innocence Exegesis. We've had a standard, pretty much, fears of Y2K and gun crime and stuff like that in the end of the world as we know it. And then we've had last week's special, which was Closure, which was kind of an Emma Hollis
character focus piece.
So how do you think the episode, the season is going at this point? How do you feel that Millennium's gone at this point with the introduction of that and the new kind of new order which it's going through?
And I feel really bad because I know that you've had like Chris Knowles on The Innocence and Exegesis, and I know that Chris is the man to talk to if you want like the defense of season 3. His writing on season 3 is amazing. I am very candidly not a big fan of the first half of the third season. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff in the second half, and hopefully I'm going to be able to talk about some of those. So I won't get into too much depth around like the wonder that is the strange, bizarre kind of like psychedelic experience that is Saturn dreaming of Mercury. But I do think my issues is that I really dislike the first half of the third season. And it's interesting because the episodes that you mention all serve like key functions. They all exist in the context of a third season that needs to do something in particular in order to work. So The Innocence and Exegesis are very much, well, look, this is the new status quo. Get used to it. We're introducing a new lead. We're introducing a new supporting cast. We're wiping away the continuity of the previous season and we're just going to get going. And on paper, that's a solid idea. I, you know, maybe would have done more to bridge the second and third seasons, but I'd understand why if you're coming in after Morgan and Wong have left, you want to clear the plate. Problem is, the execution for me is terrible. Then you have The End of the World as We Know It, or Titowaki, I think is how you pronounce that. I don't know, I'm bluffing. But you have this idea, it's very much kind of a, well, now that we've established the status quo, let's do a fairly standard episode of Millennium. And the problem with it is that it is not a very good standard episode of Millennium. And again, you can see what it's meant to do in the third season, but it's just not capable of doing it. And then you have Closure again, and Closure is again something that is essential four episodes into the season. You've introduced a new lead, Emma Hollis, and Claire Scott is great. I actually think Claire Scott's really good. And Emma Hollis conceptually is a good character, I think. She doesn't jar in the same way that, say, Monica Reyes does in the ninth season, The X-Files, where you have a character who struggles to find a center or an essence. I think that Hollis works relatively well in terms of what the production wants or needs her to do. But again, the execution of the episode itself is just terrible. It's very similar. If you want to see what Closure would look like if it was good, maybe go and see something like Invocation from the eighth season of The X-Files, which serves the same purpose in introducing us to the backstory behind John Doggett, but does it in a way with a kind of greater finesse and greater skill. And this is like, again, this is a sense of the third season knowing what it needs to do, but doing it very, 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 very clumsily, which kind of brings us neatly to the episode that we're talking about today for me, which is 13 Years Later, which is an episode that I have absolutely no idea what it's trying to do, why it's trying to do it, and what its purpose is, but which through some fluke manages to do it better than any of the four previous episodes. I would argue, and this is a very, very, very qualified endorsement, just to be absolutely clear, I would argue that 13 Years Later is the best episode of the third season to this point. I would probably go even further and argue that it is the best episode of the third season until Borrowed Time, which arrives about halfway through. It is not a good episode of television. It is not a good episode of Millennium, but at least it has some clever ideas going on and some interesting ideas simmering beneath the surface, even if it lacks focus, occasionally seems mean-spirited, is very, very broadly drawn, isn't consistently funny enough to work as the comedy that it wants to be, is largely cribbing from much better and much smarter comedy episodes in the second season, and is somehow built around the true horror of the third season of Millennium, which is a live concert by the rock band Kiss. I still think that, you know, in spite of all those problems, there are enough little things in the episode that kind of like work or kind of make sense or kind of are interesting of themselves, which kind of elevates it over the previous four episodes. And, you know, to be honest, the next four as well.
Wait, it's interesting, right? So before we go any further, I'll just do obviously some of the formalities out of the way. Okay. This obviously is called 13. It's okay. No, it's fine. It was my fault. This episode is called 13 Years Later. It was aired on the 30th of October, 1998. So just a day before Halloween. It was written by Michael R. Perry and directed by Thomas J. Wright. And obviously we're seeing, you mentioned the Kiss thing there, it's a kind of very meta episode. I would potentially disagree with what you've said with regards to the episodes before this. Innocence and Exegesis, I think, has had its moments, and I've spoken about them anyway. And The End of the World as We Know It is an okay episode. I'm not saying by any stretch of the imagination these are absolutely amazing and stand out, but they are I feel that that's okay.
I love the kind of like really tepid kind of argument that we're having here about what the highlight of this stretch of the season is. It's like, I'm not saying they're good episodes. I'm just saying they're slightly better. Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's all right. Yeah, it's fine. And I do have an affinity for the first three. I think The End of the World, as we know, I think I spoke about that, you know, as it's one of those episodes which is trying to talk about gun crime. Yeah. It's trying to talk about Y2K. It's trying to do a lot of things and wouldn't fall short in an X-File, really, in a lot of ways. But an Enclosure...
Needs a better script.
Yeah.
Needs a better script. Sorry.
Yeah, it's all right. No, it's okay. That's what we're here for. We're here to talk about our debates on what we feel. Because coming up next is Closure, which I, again, I'm not particularly that fond of. And then we get to 13 Years Later, which I personally, from me, is the worst 10-13 episode of TV ever. I do not like this episode whatsoever.
Wow.
And I've been dreading this for 3 years.
this is maybe like bad for you, but this is awful for me because I don't even like it that much, but I'm going to be in the position of having to defend it. This is like whenever somebody asks me about Batman versus Superman, where I'm like, it is not the worst movie ever. And the other person's like, fight. And I'm like, but I really don't want to.
Now, I'll put a proviso on here. So I'm looking at the Millennium This Is Who We Are.net.
Okay.
And one of the adverts for this episode was a Halloween Screams picture, which most people will have seen. And it says, if you like slasher films, you're going to love this. I don't like slasher films. So that in the first instance doesn't bode well for me whatsoever. And then I remember watching this, as I say, you know, as I've mentioned before, I keep saying 2 years. It's probably closer to 3 or 4 years now that I couldn't get through this episode on my rewatch recently. Yeah. Of that time I've watched it. I've managed to get through it twice for this podcast, actually, to do this actual podcast, and I'm not saying it's anything particularly, like, you know, that makes me angry or mad. It just, I just lose interest, and we'll get into that. But before, and people who love this episode are going to go,
what? is this the best he could do in terms of finding somebody to defend it?
Is this the most? No, is this the most that Kurt could muster to actually physically make any work on this and then end up going, oh, hang on a second, I've left it too late, I'll have to do it.
I have watched the episode. That is my research.
That is my research, is I've got through the episode twice in the space of 20 years. No, but joking aside, I mean, going back to the production of this episode as well, because this has got a really strange production value. Yes. I mean, I'm sure you're aware of this, with the whole Fox saying they want Kiss in the episode.
Yes.
Which is interesting in itself. Do you want to like give us a bit more down low on that, really?
Well, again, this is one of the weird situations where, and again, it's almost kind of a parody of Hollywood, the fact that this episode even exists. So, you know, Fox were looking for a way to make Millennium saleable. And again, this is a large part of what the third season was. The ratings were obviously on a downward trajectory. It hadn't become the hit that Fox had wanted it to be. It hadn't become the hit that, you know, the pilot and its blockbuster rating suggested that it would want to be. So Fox were very much eagerly looking for a way to get hot young 18 to 34 year old men to watch Millennium. And again,
to stress this, by the way, I was 18 at the time, so I'm just going to say that. Yeah, okay.
I know. And were you a Kiss fan, Kurt?
I was a Rock fan. I don't think I was a Kiss fan, no.
Yeah, because this is exactly the situation that you're in, where you're talking about like middle-aged men in suits in Hollywood who are trying to project what kids want from their entertainment and what will bring them in. It's the same logic that got you, for example, Coolio in the episode Or and of Space Above and Beyond, which is Fox desperately reaching into the darkness and trying to find something that would make kids watch it. Because it's worth noting that Kiss were, I believe, in the middle of something close to Kissonnaissance, is that what we'll call it? We'll call it that.
Ooh, let's go with that.
Yeah, I know. Kissonnaissance, which had really kind of kicked off, you know, in 1998 with the album Psycho Circus, which was the first album to feature all four of the original lineup since 1979's Dynasty, I think. It had been basically prompted by their insanely successful reunion tour between 96 and 97, which had grossed over $140 million. In reality, apparently, the four original members of Kiss collaborated only fleetingly on the album because they could not stand each other. In interviews surrounding his departure from the group, I think Peter Criss said that the only track on the album where all four artists appeared together was Into the Void. But that doesn't actually matter because the album was insanely successful. It peaked at third position on the Billboard charts, which is not a bad showing for an old band. I think the Rolling Stones, for example, would be very, very happy with that. The lead single, Psycho Circus, which they perform in the episode that you've just watched, became the band's first number one hit ever on Billboard's Hot Mainstream Rock chart, for example. And of course, Kiss being Kiss. And like, I am not a Kiss aficionado. I don't know much about the history of Kiss. I've mostly just absorbed it passively from pop culture. But the one thing that I do know about Kiss is that they never miss an opportunity to sell out. They'd managed to leverage a video game from the album, releasing Psycho Circus, The Nightmare Child, 2 years after the album hit the market. So if you're Kiss and you're desperate to sell out, what are you going to do? Fox are offering you a ton of money to appear on their show Millennium, and all of a sudden all the writers just have to figure out how to incorporate you into the episode Millennium. And Michael Orr Perry's talked about this, how his original pitch sounds actually surprisingly like, say, Nostalgia later in the season, in that it's about it's an episode that he'd envisaged being about a small town dealing with a Hollywood crew coming to make a movie about a set of murders that had happened there, and all of a sudden thrust into his lap is, well, yeah, but you have to make an episode that features Kiss, by the way. And also Kiss non-negotiably have demanded that they each have appearances out of makeup. So you have to find a way to write them into the episode. And I think that Perry himself has explained that only two members of the band actually have experience as actors. I believe those are Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons, who both have fairly significant roles outside of makeup. When I say fairly significant, I mean they get about a scene to themselves. Paul Stanley as Lou Carroll and Gene Simmons as Hector Leachman, aka the extra who confesses to the murder. On the other hand, Peter Criss and Ace Frehley make small cameos at the beginning of the episode with the subtlety of a sledgehammer, where, like, if you're watching the episode and you don't know that Kiss are appearing outside of makeup, you still will know that this is a cameo you're watching, because as Frank Black is walking to a crime scene, two police officers stop him and say, "Hey, Frank, it's good to see you again, Frank," and shake his hand and then continue walking, which is something that never happens on the show, doesn't make any real sense in the context of the story that's being told. And even if you have never heard of Kiss before or know that Kiss are appearing in this episode, you know that there's a reason why these two extras got lines and got to shake Frank Black's hand, even though it has no bearing on the rest of the episode. It's a very strange, experience. But yeah, basically Perry's talked about how he had to frantically rewrite the episode around the idea of a Halloween set Kiss episode. And I think he said that the only reason why he ended up being the one to write this was because his script was the only one that was in any shape by the time that the deadlines came around. So it wasn't that it was an episode that was deemed an episode that could accommodate Kiss. You know, this wasn't something like, say, Postmodern Prometheus being, you know, built around Cher and then Cher not being able to show up because she was on tour. This is very much like, well, crap, this is the only script we have. Shoehorn Kiss into it. Get them in there. Cram it in there somehow. And like, part of me, this is the thing where, and we'll talk about like how I feel about 13 years later in a bit more depth in a moment, perhaps. But one of the things that like really fascinates me, and you can almost hear me talking through gritted teeth here, I'm choosing my words very carefully, but one of the things that fascinates me about 13 years later is the episode's repeated and strong insistence that, like, in Frank Black's visions, in this part of the episode that in every other story of Millennium is used to contain horrors unimaginable, quick cut together flashes of violence, brutality, human suffering, angst, and torment on the very soul of the man. These fantastic edited sequences that famously gave broadcast standards and practices nightmares when they watched them in the pilot. These moments that speak to the true horror nestled at the heart of the American character. In 13 years later, over the course of the entire episode, Frank Black is haunted by visions of a Kiss music video, which is, you know, on the one hand, maybe clever, self-aware, self-mocking, self-ridiculing, but on the other hand is also something that seems incredibly hypocritical, in that if you are going to sell out and if you're going to be forced to build an episode around Kiss, you don't really get to tell us that the real horror at the heart of the episode is that cameo, when you have structured the episode in such a way to treat it as a climax. And again, I think Thomas J. Wright, the director, has talked about how one of the things that he did was he shot the climax like a music video. And apparently, according to Wright, Kiss had actually talked to him about using the footage for the video for the release of Psycho Circus, and it never came to pass. It's kind of interesting to imagine an alternate universe where, you know, you have Catatonia's Mulder and Scully in the fifth season of The X-Files, and you have Kiss's Psycho Circus starring Lance Henriksen as Frank Black fit appropriately at a Kiss concert, which is a very interesting parallel universe. But yeah, it's all very, very odd. I can't imagine that many 18 to 34 year old men were so eager for Kiss content that they were going to tune in to Millennium on Friday night and watch this parody, deconstruction, mockery of kind of the slasher movie genre. It's all very, very strange, Kurt.
It is very strange. And yeah, I mean, at 18, I would have, my first concert I ever went to was a Def Leppard concert. And I've been to rock concerts, I've been to heavy rock concerts, I've been to heavy metal concerts, I've been to pop concerts. And, you know, so I'm not a huge fan of Kiss whatsoever. You know, Crazy, Crazy Nights is about as far as I go with them too, to be honest with you. But, and obviously Gene Simmons is a well-known name. He's you know, at that time especially, you know, everyone knew who he was, you know, because of the character he is. But it just didn't, I think that's another reason why it's just like, it just did not connect me. This episode just does not connect with me on any level. And on top of that, I think if I want to qualify my issues with it, just before I do that though, the Kiss video as well, I think 20th Century Fox blocked that. Because obviously saying it's their property, you know, so they couldn't physically do that. And you were saying about the band members. The band members, from what I believe, is that they each wanted equal amount of dialogue as well. And it was only after they actually filmed everything that it was cut out to obviously to give the two actors more lines than the cameos.
Time,
yeah, but so it's the fact that, you know... And I actually, since reading it up more on that, and remember reading a lot of the stuff in Back to Frank Black, is that you just feel sorry for the people writing it. You feel sorry for Michael Perry. You feel sorry for Thomas J. Wright. And I personally feel sorry for the show, really.
Cast
because it's just
well,
like,
yeah.
It's just not, you know, and don't get me wrong. I know that some people do love this episode, and I know that people do hate this episode as well. There's plenty of scope in this one. But then, you know, that's the nature of the beast. Unfortunately, as I say, it's just one of those things. So where do you think IMDb puts this?
This is not fair, Kurt. I have no frame of reference. Can you cheat and can you tell me what like an average third season episode is? So like, you know, pretend that I'm not recording this ahead of time and I've listened to your past couple of episodes.
Okay.
So what does The Innocents get? What does Exegesis get? You know, like what does Tuatekeki get?
Okay.
So they're just can you give me those scores and give me a range?
7-2, 7-2, 7-3.
Ooh, okay. Now, this is good. So,
I'll add a proviso that this has got the most amount of votes in season 3.
Yeah, this is where it gets interesting. So, because I knew this was going to have a strong pull one way or the other because it's a divisive episode. So is it going to benefit from that? Is it going to end up higher or is it going to end up lower? And because it has a higher number of votes, it's going to swerve more sharply in one direction than the other. I'm going to take a wild swing. I'm going to say it's going to go lower. I'm going to say 5.8.
7.2.
Whoa! Okay, I was way off. Damn it!
217 votes.
So exactly the same as The Innocents and Exegesis then. Yeah. Nice!
Yeah. And Teotihuacan got 7.3 and Closure got 7.4. So at the moment, it's joint with the first two episodes of the season. And
okay.
Yeah, and I won't say any of the rest because you are going to be on some of the rest, but some of the scores on there are really interesting. So it's going to be an interesting IMDb year.
I'm looking forward to it.
Fantastic. What would you rate this episode for you out of 10 then?
I know this is going to make it sound like the most tepid defense ever, but 4 out of 10 for me. And it's still probably the highest rated episode for me between here and like borrowed time. Sorry.
Wow. I'm glad it's I didn't put you on the grade. First two episodes.
Yeah, it's a pass grade. Like it's you know, it's 40%. It's need to try harder, but you know, there's some good stuff here. You just need to like structure it better. And yeah, well, if we're going to be honest, the problem with 13 Years Later is that it's a comedy, but it doesn't know who the butt of the joke is supposed to be.
Yeah.
Like it's never entirely clear who or what 13 Years Later is supposed to be laughing at. Is it supposed to be laughing at Hollywood? If so, then why are all the characters two-dimensional caricatures that you've been seeing in movies for, you know, 50 years at this point? None of the insight being particularly sharp or astute. Is it laughing at the show? Because it often seems like a lot of the butt of the jokes in 13 Years Later are how incredibly dark and self-serious and self-important Millennium is. In which case, then, you know, that seems like a really mean thing to be doing at a point where the show is, you know, if we're being frank, on its last legs. It doesn't figure out what its laser focus is. Because you look at like most of the great comedies, if you look at really good comedies, and even say, you know, I mean, movies like, say, Blazing Saddles, where it's very clear that the butt of the joke is American racism. Or if you look at even episodes like Millennium, like, say, Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense, where it's very clear watching the episode that the butt of the joke is on, and I want to be very careful who I name for legal reasons, but self-osophy. But also the idea that, you know, that Millennium, it's very much aimed at the people who think Millennium is too dark or too serious. And that's where the butt of the joke lands. And it has a very clear point that it's building to. 13 Years Later doesn't. 13 Years Later just seems to take cheap shots wherever it can find them. It doesn't seem to have any overarching idea of what it's actually saying or what it's trying to articulate or what its central kind of thesis is. The comedy isn't building in a particular direction. And I mean, outside of that, the jokes themselves are kind of a little bit tired. I think there are some good jokes in here. There are some really good jokes in here that are quite funny by themselves, but there aren't enough of them. It doesn't pass. I think is it the 5-joke test? Is the kind of like the hypothetical, is this a good comedy? It doesn't get there. It maybe lands on 3, if we're being honest. And then also, yeah, just no idea of like what it's actually saying or what it's actually doing. And again, I talked about, you know, those previous 4 episodes where you can see what they're doing in laying out the third season of Millennium. 13 Years Later doesn't have that. But even in the second season of Millennium, and I know I'm a big second season cheerleader, and I know it's an acquired taste, and I apologize for coming on the third season and being like, yeah, but the second season was so much better, because I know nobody likes that. Nobody likes being that guy. Nobody likes listening to that guy. But even in the second season, where you had episodes that didn't work, you could generally say, well, I see what this is trying to do or what this is trying to say. So I can look at Sense and Antisense and say, oh, they're clearly trying to do a conspiracy episode, you know, like The X-Files, to draw us into this idea. And that's like, okay, it doesn't work, but I see what its purpose is. Or like, say, A Single Blade of Grass, where it's like, okay, they're trying to liken the destruction of a tribe to the destruction of a family, which is a key theme of the season as a whole. And they're trying to suggest the apocalypse could be something that happens on a more intimate level than like a global scale. You know, it can happen to an entire culture. And if it can happen to a culture, then it can happen to a person. And that also fits with the theme of the season as well. Or even say The Pest House, you know, which I was on and which is one of the weaker episodes of the season. Even then it's like, okay, but that's saying things about the notion of evil and the idea that the destruction of a person is in its own way an apocalypse, and that fits as part of the larger theme of the season. With 13 Years Later, I can't figure out what this is saying for the life of me. Yeah. I can't figure out what its purpose is aside from justifying the inclusion of Kiss. And you're right, it is sad, and it does feel, I'm going to say some nice things about it later on to be absolutely clear, and you're entirely right that it does feel like, to criticize Michael or Perry, or to criticize Thomas Wright or anybody involved in the production too heavily, given the constraints under which they are working, seems like bad taste and it seems unfair, and I don't want to do that. But at the same time, it doesn't work for me, I'm afraid.
Yeah. I would give this 2 7 thumbs and 4 7 fingers. personally. I would go for 2 out of 10. Personally, it's okay. it's just the maybe stuff in there. I think I tried to articulate this before and didn't really come across that well, but I think because the subject matter of using the slasher format, which is something I'm not interested in the slightest, the fact that they're trying to do a kind of a comedy episode in the style of kind of a Darren Morgan episode, and it's someone I particularly like. I don't like that fact. It's got a band I don't care about, and it's generally not funny. Yeah. So for me, it's just like, it just ticks all the wrong boxes for me. It just does not, it just doesn't do anything for me at all. And then we'll get to it towards the end. Some of the filming of Frank Black when he's got his leg up on the bed and stuff, it's like, oh God, no.
Yeah.
And you know, they're using Frank Black's voice at the doorway where Emma Hollis comes in. It's just like, I just don't like this. And normally I've switched off by then anyway. So it was nice to see that. But anyway.
This is fresh to you. This is all new Millennium content for you.
This is new Millennium content for me. The first time I've watched it since October 30. Well, it would have been in England a lot, probably a lot longer than that. It would have probably been 1999. But let's talk about the episode then. Well, we've talked about it in general. But the way that it frames it, okay, so it seems to frame it in the way that Bianco is telling his story, you know, because the framing device is him telling the story, isn't it? So
can we talk about the framing device and how awful it is and how obvious it is from the outside what it's doing and what
we can't. We've got to be positive.
What the twist is going to be. Like, you have this moment, which is like this idea of Frank Black. Like, you're meant to think it's Frank Black addressing this bunch of FBI suits about this Casey work, which is momentously important. But if you have literally ever watched any television show before, or any film, or any piece of media, you will know that despite the fact that Lance Henriksen is under contract and clearly providing the voiceover, perhaps, and also even appearing later on in the episode itself, the fact that the camera doesn't show you his face in this opening sequence is not something that happens by accident, and is not something from the way that it's shot, which is, by the way, really, really brightly overlit, terribly overlit. And again, I get the sense that Wright is very much trying to signpost the idea that, oh, this is hyper real. We're not meant to look at this as a real FBI building. But at the same time, it's so horribly overlit that there's no way to make concealing Frank's face look moody. Yeah.
He has actually said that a lot of the filming was done for that reason.
But like, you when you shoot that way, the problem is that you can't artfully conceal Frank's face or the face of the person talking. So you can't do like a long or a mid-distance shot of him speaking and have him wear Frank's clothes and maybe go, ah, maybe that is Frank speaking. The only way you could do it is to shoot literally the back of his head. And when you shoot the back of somebody's head in a movie or TV show, the immediate question that any audience member asks is, well, why aren't they showing me the front of the head? Because everybody knows that the fun and interesting stuff is on the front of the head. So clearly there's a decision that's been made to explain why they're not doing that. And as soon as this becomes an episode about Hollywood, and as soon, even before you figure out who the killer is, as soon as there's an actor in it, and even before the actor in this episode is revealed to be inverted commas method. And by the way, that's not what the method is, but that's what the method has come to mean in pop culture. But as soon as there's an actor, you know that in a story like this, the actor is going to turn out to be a quote unquote method actor. And he's going to turn out to have taken on at the very least, not to get to the spoilers about, you know, like what the episode is and then the reveal of who the killer is. At the very least, that actor will have taken on the personality and the traits of Frank Black. So when you're sitting there and you're asking yourself, gee, why aren't I seeing the face of that person who sounds a lot like Frank Black and who is even acting a lot like Frank Black, if you get my meaning? It's incredibly obvious what's going on. And that's just terrible. It's one of those things where the episode, the way that it's shot, makes it seem like the episode thinks that it's smart and it's proud of itself for figuring it out or for kind of like doing something like that. But it's not. It's just you sitting there as an audience member waiting for 40 minutes for a shoe to drop. I'm sorry. Yeah. I will try to be positive after this.
I know. It's difficult. I'm going to genuinely be upset, you know, because I love this TV show. And I'm going to be genuinely upset by the time we get to the end. Then relieved that it's over and we can go on to something like Skull and Bones, which is an interesting episode to talk about. So that'll be good. But what do you think, too? Because if this happens in TV a lot, we've got Hollywood AD and The X-Files, and I know we always refer to The X-Files, but even something as recent as Lucifer in his newest season, in season 5 actually have an episode where they end up going to a TV set. And surprise, surprise, they've got someone called Diablo, who is Lucifer. So you see, this is a trope that happens quite a lot in TV. Is it something that done well that you quite like to see with that kind of trope, or is it something that you would more normally shy away from?
Yeah, this is interesting because, again, a lot of the thing is that Hollywood really likes Hollywood. The cliche of Hollywood being kind of a self-involved, kind of self-referential place is, you know, again, not entirely unfair. And I think that there are interesting things that you can do with that. Like, I actually really genuinely adore Hollywood AD. I don't think it's as good as The Unnatural in terms of, like, David Duchovny handcrafted X-Files episodes. But I think it's fun. I think it's clever. And I think it's saying something about how Duchovny sees both Hollywood and the show itself, which makes it all worthwhile. 13 years later, and again, like, and there are any number of kind of, you know, the cliche of Hollywood liking to give Oscars to movies about Hollywood. You know, the infamous like joke about like the mess up over La La Land, but like La La Land winning the Best Director Oscar, even if it didn't take home the Best Picture Oscar. Things like, say, Argo winning Best Picture, for example. This idea that Hollywood genuinely loves to celebrate and praise itself and to laud itself and to laud its process. And even when it's kind of mocking itself kind of cheekily, as it kind of is here in inverted commas, a lot of that is kind of coming from a place of, gee, look at how amazing our lives are. Look at how insane the stuff that we have to deal with is. It's, and, you know, again, you can go to the cliche of writing what you know. I think that, you know, there are some really, really, really great examples of that. You know, I mentioned I really like Hollywood AD, but like The Player is probably my favorite movie about Hollywood, or one of my favorite movies about Hollywood. And it is very in-jokey. It's very self-aware. It's very self-referential. And it's very ironic. And again, it's probably notable that like this arrives at a time when mass media in general and film and television are becoming increasingly self-aware, you know, increasingly postmodern and increasingly ironic. It's no coincidence that like 13 years later arrived, I think, 2 years after the first Scream movie and 1 year before the third one, I think, as well, because that's very much the kind of place or the frame of mind that we're in at the moment. And again, worth noting that even the idea of characters visiting a set of a horror movie that's being made about them, you know, is not necessarily something that's particularly new or interesting or innovative at this point. It's already been done, or it will be done very shortly, in, you know, Scream 2, where the film is based around the Stab series, or even like Scream 3, where they actually end up going to Hollywood. And by the way, Lance Henriksen's there. But I think that the problem with 13 years later is that its use of Hollywood is so incredibly broad and also incredibly toothless and incredibly generic. So it's like, hey, gee, maybe producers like using cocaine in Hollywood. Maybe some people in Hollywood use drugs. Or maybe personal trainers hold just a little bit too much power. Or hey, maybe there are overqualified British character actors who are resentful of the fact that the only work they can get is in genre fare. All of this is stuff that you have seen done countless times before and have seen done a lot better. And I mean, there is some arguably, if you want to be incredibly generous to 13 years later, you would say that there is maybe something in there about the sleaziness of Hollywood and the corruption of Hollywood. And like, I'll go on record. I will say that, like, I think Scream 3 is the weakest Scream movie by a considerable margin. I think it's the weakest of the set. But rewatching Scream 3 recently, it is a movie that is quite biting about Hollywood, particularly in hindsight, particularly in its exploration of things like the exploitation of women in Hollywood. Like, I remember watching Scream 3 after the Me Too and the Harvey Weinstein stuff came out and feeling genuinely uncomfortable with it. I don't think it's a particularly good movie, but I think it actually has teeth in what it's saying about Hollywood and about what it does. 13 years later, like, if you want to be generous, broadly gestures in that direction with the idea of kind of, you know, that these sleazy executives only showing up for the shooting of a nude scene, for example. Yeah. But at the same time, and again, this is something we're going to come back to in like my big criticism of 13 years later, and this idea that it's a joke that doesn't know who the butt of the joke is supposed to be. It's insanely hypocritical because you have this sequence of the leering, like, peering men, the guys in suits who show up to watch a beautiful woman get naked and kind of just gawk at her, and kind of like maybe try to sleep with her or convince her to sleep with them in order to get a better part or to get bumped up the food chain, which is, you know, again, is a very dark idea and a very familiar sort of story about what, you know, what Hollywood is like. But 13 years later doesn't really get into it, just gestures at. But at the same time, you have the opening sequence where you have the character, you know, the idea of a character being murdered in the shower. This again, this idea of kind of the slasher movie, the female body, the objectification of the female body, and the objective, you know, the celebration of the voyeuristic suffering of young women for an audience eager to devour it. But within the same episode, you then have the actress literally zip down the front of her dress to reveal her cleavage to the camera. And it's like, what is 13 years later saying? It's like 13 years later is just, the episode is just as leering and just as voyeuristic and just as objectifying of its like female actors as the movies or the industry that it seems to be parodying. And as a result, it kind of, it all feels rather hollow, if we're being frank.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think? Going back to the, it's probably a good point to come into this. What do you think to the, you know, you're saying like the beginning of the framing of it, that this is basically, the story's being told from Mark Bianco's point of view, effectively, because it's, I don't see this being as something that's genuinely happened. That he's meant to be that method, that it's, that he's actually done this himself in his own head. But the way that is written, because there's all these film tropes, all the slasher film tropes. I mean, you say with the shower and stuff like that, and the inclusion of that, even to the point where Emma's actually going through all of the films as well.
Yeah.
And many of which I won't get references to be absolutely fair to them. But yeah, it does want to like kind of frame it in that way that, you know, it's the storytelling. You're not quite sure which point of view you're coming from, even though it is effectively meant to be Mark Bianco's viewpoint, really, because he's telling it in that asylum.
And by the way, like, Mark Bianco, enjoy it, ladies and gentlemen. Mark Bianco's name is one of the best jokes in this episode, because he's Bianco and he's playing black, because Bianco is Italian for white. But yeah, like, again, and this is one of the things where one of the laughs in the episode, one of the things in the episode that I actually quite enjoy is the joke where, you know, Frank says, okay, quick, we gotta, you know, he's going to become a slasher and all the cast and crew are in this hotel right now. We got to act quickly. And he pulls out his gun and he kind of cocks it. And then Emma says, but wait, I thought you stopped carrying a gun, which is obviously a reference, you know, to the end of the world as we know it and continuity. And it becomes a kind of a continuity gag. And you have like Lance Henriksen or Frank Black kind of awkwardly, like his eyes kind of squirming, almost looking at the camera as we fade to black. And like, that's a joke that I kind of like, in the moment, I like, because it's very much like, yeah, we broke continuity. We're literally breaking the fourth wall in one of the most pointed ways possible. We're having characters point out, not that this doesn't make sense in the real world, in inverted commas, which is something that I dislike that sense of irony where you have characters in, say, Marvel movies say, gee, isn't it weird that we're in this situation, which is like a situation from a comic book and not real life? How weird is that? Yeah. It's a more interesting and more subtle form of irony, which is operating by the rules of the story that we're in. Didn't you just break those rules? Which is kind of like, it's a slightly subtler variation on the gag, which is kind of, I like, because it gives it a little extra level. But it also, as you pointed out, like one of the central tensions of the episode is the idea that this entire story is being narrated by Mark Bianco and he is an entirely unreliable narrator. And really, that's one of the only indications that you get of it. That's one of the only points in the episode where you can really say, ah, this doesn't make sense. Ah, this can't possibly be happening. Ah, this can't possibly be in continuity with the other episodes of Millennium, because the characters have pointed out that it can't be. But it's such a strange moment, because it's quite literally the only moment in the episode where that really happens. They're the only moment in the narrative that we're told where it really happens. And I do wonder if maybe Michael or Perry's script contained more moments like that, which would have kind of hinted at it. And again, a sense of like Thomas Wright's direction, where it's, you know, parts of it are overlit as well to make it seem hyper real. But it's also like, it's not overly stylized. It's not kind of, it doesn't push far enough that it becomes almost parody, which I think is kind of something that harms it, because it ends up kind of stuck in the middle between these two extremes, where you have this one small joke, which I think is hilarious, but which doesn't fit with the tone or the mood or like the general sense of the rest of the episode around it. So it's a very odd piece. And again, it's something where you feel like, if Darren Morgan or Vince Gilligan, and again, this feels very unfair to Michael or Perry, and I apologize for that, but if, say, Vince Gilligan or if, say, Darren Morgan had been writing a comedy episode like that, it would be a lot more self-aware, it would be a lot more playful, it would be a lot smarter and shrewder in setting up ideas like that, as opposed to just treating it as a, you know, throwaway joke to fade to black on, which doesn't really work. And by the way, it is literally a fade to black because it's Frank Black.
Maybe you should have got involved. But we also get things like, which really frustrates me as well, and I don't want to do this, is when Bianco puts his glasses on and you get the dum-dum.
Which is great because it predicts like CSI Miami. Like, it's amazing. It, like, watching it in hindsight, I do really like that kind of, like, that self-referential bit where he puts on and you get the name score and you get kind of like, it is very much like they're parodying something that doesn't exist when this episode aired. I'm kind of like, I can see that.
That's fair enough. I think it's the compounding of everything else that makes it's probably a good time to say that Jeff Yeager obviously is Megan Gallagher's husband as well.
Yeah.
And I quite like the fact that I don't know what his history of his name is, but the fact that it's Yeager as in half of Gallagher is interesting in itself, really. So what about Frank then? Because, go on.
Well, even then, I was going to say, like, the casting of Jeff Yeager is one of those things where, again, it's not really in service of anything, but it's clever enough that I'm kind of like, okay, I might bump you up to a pass grade. Because, again, 4 out of 10 is a pass grade. Where it's like, you have Catherine Gallagher's husband playing an actor playing the husband of the character that was played by Megan Gallagher.
Yeah.
You know, I see, like, there's a sense of symmetry there where it's kind of like a little bit of an inside joke where you have her husband playing her screen husband, like, mirrored through a prism. And it's like, they don't do anything with it. It doesn't build to anything resembling a point. It's just something that's, like, smart in inverted commas on its own terms. And it's like, I wish you'd done something with that beyond just doing it.
Yeah.
But the fact that you did it, I think, indicates that you put some thought into it. So I kind of like it, I guess. Yeah. This is really terrible. I'm adding a really terrible defense of this episode.
I'm sorry. You are trying to defend it, though, because I am trying to say stuff and you are defending it. So we'll take it for that. I do personally like that. What do you think is, taking everything aside, what do you think of his portrayal as that character of him trying to play Frank Black? Because I actually do think it's quite good, to be fair. I think he does a good job of it.
I think Yeager does really good work here. Like, I think it is a good performance. I just think that Bianco is a thankless role. Yeah. It is such, and again, so much of this episode is populated by thankless roles, because, like, to describe many of the supporting characters as one dimensional doesn't, like, feels like an insult to the phrase one dimensional. Where it's like, hey, he's a personal trainer, now he's a director. How hilarious is that, that Hollywood works in such a way? Ha! And I'm like, no, please make it stop. But I think that, like, and again, I mentioned it earlier, but, like, Bianco as the actor going, and again, this is not what the method actually is, but going inverted commas method is such a lazy joke, where it's like you're making a movie about a slasher killer and you're going to reveal that it's the actor who has gone so method that he's killed people. That's a tired premise. Like, that's a premise that might have been funny on an Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode in the 60s, at a push. Now we've assimilated so much culture, we've watched so many satires and so many spoofs, and we've seen and heard so many stories about like real life actors like, say, Daniel Day-Lewis or Robert De Niro, you know, dating back to, I think, the late 70s, early 80s at the, you know, at the very latest, that, you know, we accept all this stuff for granted, that it's going to be the actor going method is pretty much the default assumption in a murder mystery set on a slasher set. And it's such a low ball, and it's such an easy ball, and it's so tired. It's exhausting. And again, this is one of the things where if I wanted to mount a defense of this, and to be fair, let's be charitable and let's assume that it's positive. I kind of like that the episode, and again, this is one of the things where it's a big problem with the episode, but it almost works in the moment, where the episode ends up being so bleakly nihilistic that it ends up kind of like almost subverting that cliche of the method actor, because you have Frank Black kind of do the thing, you got so deep into my character that you ended up murdering people. It's like, no, actually, I just murdered the first two to find out. Then it turned out that I was actually an undiagnosed psychotic. And it's like, it's that moment kind of works of itself for me, because it's like parodying, you know, a certain type of serial killer kind of drama, where, again, you know, if you want to say that it's laughing at Millennium, and we'll talk about how it's kind of laughing at Millennium and why that makes me a little bit uncomfortable maybe later on, but kind of like shows, stories like, say, Manhunter, or shows like Hannibal, or books like Red Dragon, you know, that kind of cliche of the idea of somebody who gets so deep into the psyche of a serial killer that they become a serial killer, and how there's a tendency to treat that as kind of like, and again, I think there are really, really great examples of that. I really like, is it Grotesque from the third season, The X-Files?
Yeah.
I really like that episode, you know, and it's a very moody, very operatic thing to do. But I also think that it's kind of funny to take that and go, actually, no, I didn't do it because I got lost inside the mind of a serial killer. I did it just because I'm a psychotic and I enjoy killing people. And it's a moment. It lands in the moment because it's kind of funny. But it kind of then gets back to, well, what is 13 years later about? Because, you know, at least if he is a method actor who has gone so method that he's murdered people, you might get a comment on the vacuous nature of Hollywood and how completely empty it is. Or if he was just an actor trying to drum up PR, you might get a comment on, you know, that broad satirical comment on the idea of like actors looking for celebrity or fame, or, you know, or if he just became so subsumed by Frank Black that he ended up like being conquered by these demons, you might get a succinct commentary on the idea that, you know, maybe an actor who becomes an empty vessel into which he pours a character is an unhealthy way to approach kind of the idea of acting as a profession. But none of that's there. It's just a cheap punchline. There's nothing that it's punching towards. It's just a little joke that lands in the moment but doesn't say anything.
So right, okay, I'm going to try and be generous.
Okay. So your turn. It's my turn to try and be generous.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask the question of it, like you say. So Frank Black had these cases 13 years ago at the time of airing, and 13 years later he comes back to a movie set which are talking about the event of what actually happened on those times, and it's over dramatization of what actually occurred. And whether or not that they're trying to get that across, but then is that really something that really sets to mind? And what they were trying to achieve was that, you know, that truth is stranger than fiction. That you know, that Hollywood do kind of just what's the word? I'm trying to think what the word would be. Kind of just make
exploit.
It more frivolous or exploit it. Yeah. Is that what this episode's trying to do while also being a parody?
No, this is the thing, is that, like, again, when we get back to what it's trying to say, and like, it's obvious imitators. And again, like, many of the best jokes in 13 years later are transparently stolen from other better earlier scripts, which is not necessarily a good look. So things like Bianco playing Frank Black in a Hawaiian shirt, which is a joke that obviously comes from Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense, which is a much funnier episode. Or, for example, the joke of like Frank Black diagnosing famous serial killers from movies, which comes from, you know, Midnight of the Century, which is a much better episode, and instead gets kind of drawn out and kind of stretched out to an extended sequence here. Like, the thing with that relationship to Hollywood, and the idea that Hollywood is cynically exploiting like real life events for its own gain and its own advantage, which is an entirely fair criticism, to be clear. And again, it's something that we are becoming more mindful of in recent years. Look at, say, the controversy over Green Book 2 years ago and the question of whose story Green Book was and what we use that story to say and to make ourselves feel and how we exploit that, which is, again, it's an interesting idea. My issue with like 13 years later is that in that context, what you have is, on the one hand, you have the Hollywood crew being really vacuous and really mean spirited and really exploitative, taking advantage of the suffering of these people who are obviously brutally murdered. And this community, which implicitly, but not really, because the focus of the story isn't on the community, the focus of the story is on the actors and on the kind of cast and crew. But this community that hypothetically is still dealing with the scars of that kind of tragedy that happened there 13 years earlier, versus what also seems to be the case of like an episode that is roundly mocking Millennium itself. Because like when Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense kind of mocks the idea of, well, just ignore the darkness, push the darkness away, forget about the darkness, just be happy, just focus on your own happiness as the most important thing in the world. When it does that, at least Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense has Frank Black actually work as a moral center of the episode, where the jokes aren't on Frank, so to speak. Like, the jokes are Frank's deadpan reaction to the absurdity of the situation in which he finds himself. And again, one of the best jokes in Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense is that wonderful push the darkness away from you, where Frank just pushes the tape recorder off the table. And that makes it very clear what the episode's saying. And the episode's saying that, you know, you can't be that self-involved, or you shouldn't be that self-involved. And if you are, you will cease to like actually help other people and cease to be a part of the world. The problem with 13 years later is that while those criticisms of the Hollywood characters are entirely fair and entirely correct, if drawn a little more broadly, the episode also then turns Frank Black himself into something of a punchline. Like, his response to this idea, you know, his response to Hollywood's observation that people need stories, you know, the personal trainer turned director's observation that people need stories that inspire them. They don't need stories about, you know, sad and ugly people in dreary backgrounds, which again is, you could read as a criticism of Millennium. You know, you could read like the reality that the director is critiquing there is the, arguably the reality of, say, the first season of Millennium, where, you know, it's dark and depressing and it's full of very, very ugly people doing unpleasant things. But in response to that, the episode doesn't have Frank make a positive argument. It doesn't have Frank explain, you know, why it's important not to distort events or why it's important to acknowledge the harsh realities. Instead, Frank describes this really weird boilerplate and obviously falsifiable assertion that, you know, stories need to be about characters who are heroic and virtuous and true, and it needs to be earnest and it needs to be overwrought, which is not how you respond to that argument. It turns Frank into a parody of himself. And then repeatedly throughout, you have this kind of, and again, it's a good joke. I think this is the last of the three jokes that I laughed at, but it's a good joke, but it's a joke that undercuts the show and Frank horrifically, is the moment where Frank, and he says it twice in the episode, this person is trying to drive me insane for the third time in my life. Yeah. And like in that moment, the butt of the joke is Frank himself, and implicitly Millennium the TV show, and the idea that Millennium the TV show is built around a character who has been driven insane three times but is still profiling serial killers in spite of that, which is admittedly an inherently absurd premise. But if you're acknowledging that, you don't get to use that character as a moral high ground. You don't get to have Frank say, yeah, well, it's important to be respectful of the real world, while also pointing out that Frank himself is an incredibly fictional construct, because there's no way that a real person who had three psychotic breakdowns would be allowed back into the FBI to do the job that he's doing. Yeah. It just, again, it feels like it constantly undermines itself. There's a sense of hypocrisy there where it's trying to have it every which way and it can't decide what its actual viewpoint is. It just goes for the cheapest laughs as kind of simply as it can. So I do think that like that that commentary that you could have on this idea of how Hollywood works and how Hollywood takes stories and takes stories away from, you know, people and communities where they're important. At the same time, the episode doesn't seem to actually be interested in that. Like, and I pointed out, but like the way in which, you know, it seems to be mocking slasher movies. It seems to be having a joke. You know, it seems to be like ridiculing the sleaziness of them, the exploitiveness of them. But it's also itself shamelessly capitalizing on them as well. Like, it's as interested in seeing those women look nude and kind of get stabbed as the films that it's seemingly mocking are. So it really seems it doesn't have any, it doesn't really have any moral perspective to be making the judgments that it gestures broadly towards for me. And so that horrendously undercuts it from my point of view, I think.
Yeah, I mean, going back to that joke, I mean, I personally think it's frivolous, and I don't like that joke at all.
For the third time in my life.
For the third time in my life, yeah. It was like, ugh. And I think it was especially the fact that, you know, especially season one of Frank, as Frank Black, he's recovering from that. Season two, you know, his wife has died and he's, you know, he's suffered majorly in the space of the last 20 seconds to 2 minutes of that final episode of season two. And for them to throw that into the fourth episode of the season, or not only five episodes after that has happened, it was just like, it doesn't work for me.
I can see that. And particularly like in the context of a show that is struggling, like is transparently struggling. Like if you are being forced to shove Kiss into your Halloween special by the suits, desperate to get those young eyes on the screen, like you are not in a position to be laughing at how absurdly overwrought you are. You are not in a position of strength to be punching down on yourself.
Yeah. And then wait, I'm just thinking of this right as we speak, but you think of just the sheer difference in last year's Halloween special compared to this year's Halloween special. That it's just it is literally just incredible to think of the chasm that's opened there. And one joke that does land for me actually is the one where he comes up in the Jeep, which I do quite like that. I do like the fact that he comes in the Jeep and he starts talking about the phone book and the way that Frank just goes no. And I do think, you know, the sharpness of him, you know, I think that goes back to referring to, you know, the over-dramatization, because I think they said he's a quadriplegic or something early in the episode. And
the first victim was a 40-year-old quadriplegic who was killed in her driveway. Now she's a co-ed being murdered in the shower.
And another scene that actually I find, even though it's not a humorous scene, I actually do like it, and it's a testament to Frank's characters when we talk about those execs being in the insurance guys and stuff in the pool, which is very reminiscent of an X-File episode, that pool scene. But I'm sure there's plenty of slasher movies that's been referred to. But is when he has genuine concern for her, because he's thinking, where's Ruby? You know, is she coming back? Because he knows there's a thing on her life potentially, and you know, you do get Frank at that moment. It's like one of the only moments within the show that you actually see Frank for who he really is. And then obviously when she comes out and say, you're the producer kind of thing, I was like, oh, well, I don't mind that. That's okay. I'm okay with that.
But again, like the fact is that like Frank, it's hard to believe Frank could have empathy for any of the characters in this story, because the story itself doesn't have any empathy for them. Like it doesn't care about who these people, like Jose Chung's doomsday defense. Like again, it feels really bad for like Michael or Perry that I'm like, yes, but let's compare it to who one of the writers who is universally agreed to be one of the best 10-13 writers of all time. But like in that, you think of things like, say, you know, obviously Jose Chung himself to pick an example, but even things like the self-philosophy Psycho, who's given a clear arc and a clear moral structure and a clear explanation for who he is and where he came from, and is treated as an object of kind of curiosity. Or even say the Nostradamus Nutball, who doesn't even get a name, but in who a few lines of dialogue you get this kind of sad story about the breakup of a relationship and a man who's incapable of coming to terms with that. You get none of that for any of the characters here. No. None of the characters here are anything more than a punchline, which makes it very, very hard for, and you're right, by the way, in terms of Frank's characterization. You know, Frank's supposed to be mulled on like Will Graham, you know, this extreme empath, this idea of somebody who has compassion and empathy and understands and kind of like is motivated by a desire to prevent the harm that is done to others. But if the script itself doesn't care about any of these people, how it's again, and I think Henriksen is very good here. Henriksen is always very good, to be absolutely clear. But like, it's too much to ask Henriksen to sell that idea when the script doesn't buy it at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I don't think it's all right. I'm running out of things to try and talk about this episode. Anyway, anyone who doesn't like this episode is surely by now turned off. So we're all right. The other thing that kind of, because you're talking about the Nostradamus thing, and the actual Frenchman gets brought up in this episode, and you know, as part of the thing, and you already mentioned the scene with Emma, where it kind of characterizes Emma a little bit in this one, because you know, all we've seen is enclosure really about her, and I know we'll get to see more in Human Essence with a random cousin, which we'll go into in more detail when we get there, but at least we do get some, and I think this is probably the best part of the episode for me, that we do see some of Emma's like characteristics coming out a little bit, that you know, that she does like these horror slasher movies, but then she's basically got told just watch the TV and be the person there to let me know what's going on, which in itself is a strange thing. Just tell me what's on the TV at the time, which I understand that, but I don't think that lands. But it is a good little thing for Emma, really, for us to get more of an idea who she is.
And again, like, you know, you can see what the episode is broadly trying to do, where earlier on they explain the conventions of the slasher movie, where the female lead inevitably confronts the villain at the climax of the episode. And so you have the idea that, you know, Emma is the, you know, female lead of this story, even though she's not actually in the movie herself. So she ends up being targeted, you know, by Bianco at the climax, because this is obviously a slasher movie and she has been cast in the role of the final girl. But the episode kind of, and again, you know, you're hesitant to say botch it, because narratively speaking, Frank is the hero of this show. And so Frank has to get the final conflict with Bianco. But it still feels like, you know, the episode is fumbling in the general direction of an idea that works, but doesn't get there, lacks the follow through or the commitment of it. And what I will say, actually, I do think is quite clever, is that I think early on, you see Emma in the bathtub reading Labyrinths, the Borges book, which is again kind of like a nice example of, you know, the show. And if you wanted to be kind of like sarcastic and cynical, you would say an unearned nod towards postmodernism. But I think it's fair to say it's the episode gesturing towards kind of its postmodernism and its self-awareness. I just don't think that it the execution is good enough to kind of like to land that idea or to sell that idea, I think.
No, I don't think overall, no, but at least it's something. Which does, at least they've tried that. And then really, obviously, we find out that we get the kiss video, and obviously within this as well, that obviously, and then we've talked a little bit about the kiss episode, the kiss filming, and the, you know, that Frank's on the set and stuff. But yeah, I've got nothing else really to say. I don't know if there's anything else you want to bring up. There's probably loads, but I'm struggling, to be honest.
Again, the idea of kind of like the slasher movie stuff in there, as somebody, like, I know you don't like slasher movies. Mm. I really like slasher movies, as in, like, I have a huge soft spot for them when they are done well. They are just not done well enough consistently is the problem with them. Like, I genuinely think that, say, Scream and Scream 2 are two of the best kind of movies of the 90s, because they're incredibly well-produced and incredibly self-aware. The problem with, like, you know, 13 years later is that it's entering a climate where audiences have already seen movies like Scream. And so know that, like, you can know how to tell this story, but know how to tell this story better than, you know, this does. Like, I feel like I'd probably be more forgiving of, like, 13 years later if it was, you know, a second or third season episode of The X-Files, when it was the early 90s, when people weren't quite used to seeing this sort of postmodernism rendered on screen. But it feels like it arrived so late. Like, you'd already had the first two Scream movies at this point. So why, you know, why can't you do it better? And again, that's the thing with the references to the existing slasher movies, is that, like, I love those slasher movies. I think they're great. I have a huge soft spot for them as somebody who would have devoured them as a kid, but it feels rather lifeless in terms of the kind of tribute that you're paying to them. It's again, it's kind of like The Pest House. The Pest House had a similar problem, but I think The Pest House had like stronger underlying ideas, which elevated it. But you have this sense that like, okay, but if you're going to give us a Psycho homage, which is what you open with, and by the way, again, worth noting, director Thomas J. Wright started out as a storyboard artist working with Hitchcock, so you yes. have a very strong connection there as well. If you're going to give us a Psycho homage, and the episode literally opens with that shot of the showerhead deliberately evoking Psycho, then commit to it, then actually follow through on the idea. And actually kind of like shoot it in a more heightened and kind of stylized manner. Use the Dutch angles or be willing to use, say, black and white, for example, or be willing to even kind of emulate the shots shot for shot if you're going to do it that way. Mm. The kind of the slasher homages in 13 Years Later are all very, very, very broad. They're not particularly specific, or they don't feel like they've been lifted directly. They don't feel like they're quoting. It often, you know, Hollis, to fair play to her as both an FBI agent and a movie critic, they don't feel like they're sufficiently kind of like anchored in the stories that are the films that they're supposedly emulating to justify the connection that she makes them. Like, again, if she hadn't mentioned The Omen, I would not have picked up The Omen as an homage of that character just being dropped from the ceiling. I wouldn't got that was a reference there, for example. But yeah, it all feels so tired and so half-hearted and so shallow and so empty. And it's incredibly underwhelming, which is a shame. And it's kind of disappointing that I mentioned this is my favorite episode of the third season to this point, because it's not a good episode.
No. And I do apologize for all those people who like this episode. You know, what can we do? There's nothing more we can do, really. We can only say what we can see, and, you know, I am not a person who generally has a hate of an episode, or I'm always looking to find the good in stuff. And no matter what episode, whatever my personal feelings on it, if it's not a great episode, I'll probably still rate it 6 out of 10, 7 out of 10, because, you know, it's a lot of the times Millennium or The X-Files is a lot better than the TV that's around it at the time. But for me, this one... just doesn't touch upon any of it. And I can only be truthful in what I feel about it.
Like, Buffy the Vampire Slayer is running rings around this. Like, this is trying to do something similar to what Whedon was doing on Buffy the Vampire Slayer at the same time. And Buffy was just miles ahead of it, basically. And again, without even trying or without even making a big deal of it, it's really disappointing. If we want to talk about one more thing, and I'm sorry, this is going to be a mean thing, but still, it really annoys me. The closing shot and the closing gag, the two severed thumbs up, and he holds the fist to the camera. Yeah. And his thumbs haven't... It would be a joke if his thumbs had been severed, but they're not.
He's just hiding them.
He's just hiding them. So it's like, why? Why is he... Like, what is the joke here? It's like, he gave it two thumbs up and they're severed thumbs because it's a slasher movie. But then he's also, like, not raising his thumbs. Is he not giving it two thumbs up? What's going on here? I don't understand this. This is not funny. I think you think this is funny, but this is not funny. This is just confusing. And slightly enraging. And it's awful. And it's done in such a mugging, self-satisfied way. It's like a cherry on top. Cause it's like, you could cut that line out. You could just like fade to black on his face on the reveal that he's in a psychiatric institution. And the episode would be done. It would be a bad episode, but it would be done. But no, you keep those additional 2 seconds in there as like a capstone on it, because you think that's going to leave me walking away from this episode with a grin on my face. And it's so, so ill-judged, and it's so tired, and it's like, it just feels like it's like, we need to close on a gag. Has anybody got something funny? And everybody shrugs their shoulders, and it's like, okay, fine, we'll go with the first draft. It's exhausting.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing that's become good of it, even though that I've only ever got to the end of it three times in 20 years, is that I was able to rate this 2 severed thumbs out of 10. That's the only reason why I actually like that scene now. I mean, we've talked about the themes and everything like that, but I think we'll have a quick look at the feedback. There's only two posts on we'll quickly do that.
One good thing, then I'll close with a compliment sandwich. The thing is, I actually really love the clever opening like line, which is "Never believe anything you see on Halloween," from Reverend M. Goodman from 1985, which is 13 years before the episode takes place.
That's good.
I thought that was actually quite clever. Again, it's the smallest of gestures, the idea that this is out of continuity, in inverted commas, because it kind of feels like that. I think it's the Alan Moore, these are all imaginary stories, but aren't they all, kind of thing, which is like, okay, fine, I can get on board with it. And I do, that I actually do quite like about it, to be fair.
Well, this episode can certainly not be around in my ethos anymore. So, so I'll gladly take that that opening schedule. And if I ever come to it, I'll be like, oh, nope, this one doesn't exist. So let's have a quick look in the mailbag before we close up for the day. Shall we do that now? Okay, so Russ Hugo's been on. He says, while it's not a great episode of TV, I do not understand the hate it gets. It's clear that all involved knew that it was a campy pastiche, and the tonal variety from the rest of the season is, to me, a positive. Jeff Yeager's energetic and knowingly goofy performance is a real highlight and carries much of the episode, particularly in the third act. The genre is appropriate for Frank to be integrated in for some minimal satire. It's not reaching in for Darren Morgan-esque pathos, critique and humour. For what it is trying to do, it's fine. The often-mentioned video marathon with Emma and Frank is really sweet, and perhaps it's justification enough for the overall fairly weak episode. Yeah, I think the Emma-Frank scene is probably the best part highlight. Of it. Yeah, yeah. I do like that actual scene. And if you do look for a GIF file in on Twitter...
It's the only one for Millennium. When you search for Millennium, it's the only one that comes up. And to be fair, like, I mean, I did joke that it was ripping off like a really good joke from was it Midnight of the Century? But it is like, I like Claire Scott a great deal, and I think Emma Hollis works on paper. I think that the show maybe struggled a little bit to characterize her as well as it could over the course of its run. But I do think that like that moment of her and Frank sitting down, having popcorn and watching TV together. And also the idea that Frank is the worst possible person to watch a movie with. In the same way that I imagine I, for some people, am probably the worst possible person to watch a movie with, was kind of something that I actually genuinely like, because it seems like it comes from a place of affection, where it's very much like the bit where he explains the hockey mask in Friday the 13th, which is adorable, which is, you know, hockey gets young men gets you her son. That's the connection. It's like, wow, he would be such a great horror movie critic. Maybe not great fun to be around, but he'd be a really good critic. Yeah. And yeah, so kind of like that moment is very cute, and it's very sweet. It's very affectionate. And it has a lot of the warmth that I think we pointed out is lacking from the rest of the episode around it. So I would agree with that. I really do like that sequence.
Yeah, I would say that for me, the phone book scene, the scene where he's looking for Ruby because she's under the water, the three highlights. If I'm going to be positive, which I'm going to be, those are the three highlights for me. And then Christian Ponce, he says, better than expected, without being a great episode. It has many very funny moments, and somehow anticipated several of the resources that they would use in the following year in Hollywood AD. So we briefly mentioned Hollywood AD there, but... obviously, this does predate Hollywood AD, but as I mentioned before, this isn't a trope that hasn't been done before, but Hollywood AD does by far do it a hell of a lot better.
I think it does. I think it's also that Hollywood AD has something that it wants to say. And again, like, you know, you're going to be talking about it in the X-Cast, so I don't want to step on that too much. But it very much comes from a place of David Duchovny having stuff that he wants to say about his relationship to Hollywood, stuff that he wants to say about his relationship to the X-Files in particular. And that kind of shines through. I'm like, we've talked through this on the episode. I'm trying to figure out what 13 years later is trying to say, aside from the fact that Fox made us put Kiss in an episode. And I can't come up with anything, because every time I try to come up with something, there's always a huge asterisk hanging over it. There's always a huge amount of kind of like contrary evidence on top of it. I think that's my big problem with it, is that like it,
it's not about anything. It's just there. It's just taking up space, sucking oxygen out of the room.
Maybe that's the point in itself. Maybe that's the point. Maybe we're looking at it a completely different way. That
the real 13 years later was the friends we made along the way. But I will say, actually, I did, like, again, as I pointed out, I do think that there are funny jokes in there. And I do think, like, it's an easier watch for me than a lot of episodes around it. And I do, like, I know you hate it, but I genuinely love the trying to drive me insane for the third time in my life.
Fantastic. Well, that's what we'll finish on as well. That's the final note of today's episode. Thank you, everyone, for listening again. You'll be back next week to hear us talk about Skull and Bones, and that's going to be with a couple of new other guests, which we'll leave to then. But, Darren, you'll be coming back for Borrowed Time. So, as you say, back into the second half of the season, or the, you know,
or getting close enough,
Yeah, pretty much.
I'm actually thrilled about that. I promise I will be more positive on Borrowed Time. I actually really like Borrowed Time a great deal. I think there's a lot to recommend. I think it has some very obvious shortcomings, but I also think that there's a lot going on in it. So please, please, please don't think that I'm going to spend those episodes complaining and whining like I have spent the past hour. I'm sorry to anybody who really liked 13 years later.
yeah, we might have to do an alternative commentary track or something.
An alt edit.
Thank you very much. So where can people, what are you up to, and where can people find you online, Darren?
You can find me online at Darren_Mooney. I write at The Movie Blog. That's with a zero instead of an O in the word movie. I also write at The Escapist, where I write a couple of columns twice weekly there. So I write the In the Frame and occasionally have other movie opinions as well. I think as we're releasing this, I may possibly be appearing on some more Escapist related content. So I may be co-hosting a podcast there with the wonderful Bob Chipman, and the fantastic Jack Packard as well. So I'm really, really looking forward to that, and really glad to be able to share that with people. I've also co-host another podcast called The 250 with my good friend Andrew Quinn. Kurt's actually been a guest on it, and I'm hoping this is going out in late October. So with a bit of luck, you will be joining us in a couple of weeks to talk about Shutter Island as part of our very, very, very belated, but I think we have an excuse with everything else that's happened in the world, Summer of Scorsese, where we are looking at Martin Scorsese's movies on the list. Yes, it is going to take us literally into winter. We are coming towards the end of it, and you will hopefully be joining us for a discussion of Shutter Island with the fantastic Jay Coyle, and I'm really, really, really looking forward to that. You can find that with Googling us. Just search for us, and we're on Twitter at @the250, so give us a listen if you like talking about the IMDb's top 250 movies of all time.
Yeah, a particularly good movie of mine. I love Shutter Island and what it did. So, yes, I'm looking forward to recording that. That will be fantastic.
I'm looking forward to putting out DiCaprio on our Scorsese season.
Right, okay. Back to order. But you can find me on Twitter at rmuldrake, rmuldrake. The X-Files will be, X-Cast will be underway. No doubt by this point, or very soon, at least anyway, at the time of recording. So you can find us on the X_cast, and we're covering season 6. So we're into the 6th season now, which is fantastic. And you can also find me on my newest podcast, which we've got going, which is the Shipwrecked and Comatose, which is a Red Dwarf podcast. And we're currently doing season 2. That's all recorded in the bag. Just need to edit that ready for airing. So that'll be coming in, as well as some Christmas specials and stuff that we're going to be doing for that, with season 3 coming in January. And then any news on Star Trek Picard that we may get will be showcased on the Make It So podcast, which is part of the We Made This Podcast Network as well. And you can find that at Jean-Luc Podard, which is a particular favourite Twitter handle of mine that Tony came up with, which was fantastic. So Darren,
amazing Twitter handle.
It is, absolutely. We shall see you in a few episodes' time for Borrowed Time. But in the meantime, remember, everyone, this is who we are.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Pick a disc.
And I bought Riot first, and I was like, oh, I really like this. And then I went back and bought their first album, which I can't think of the name of the first one right now. But I listened to Riot more than I did the first one, for sure. Yes, I recently found my old iPod, and you know how it used to, there's a section under settings that would tell you your most listened to songs. This was the top, like, however many tracks it is, like 14 slots. And then it was everything else I listened to.
Right in the childhood.
Robin, the hooded man, doo-doo. Mate, before we do anything else, that soundtrack.
Yeah, you're a big fan of it, aren't you? Digging it. I could see the admiration for it in your little twinkle in your eyelids.
Oh, it twinkle, it brought a tear. It's beautiful, beautiful music by a band called Clannad, who obviously played that kind of music generally. Yeah. And it won a BAFTA.
Oh, okay.
That's because it deserved it.
Yeah. You know what? It definitely fit the aesthetic to the show.
Cinemortuary Podcast.
Yeah, I want to say, and I don't like say this lightly, but this might be my favourite 2 minutes of any film we've reviewed on the podcast so far.
Yeah, it's pretty fucking wild. It is pretty wild.
Sure. If I was given the director's chair and $5 million, this is the sort of thing I'd do.
You'd do that for 90 really minutes.
Yes.
Messing with the roulette wheel
just
again.
Just non-stop.
What if he vomits playing cards? Beautiful.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced by Tony Black and Kurt North. We can be found on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod or by searching Facebook for The Time Is Now. We are part of the We Made This podcast network, which can be found on Twitter at We Made This Pod or on the website wemadethispod.com. For bonus material and exclusives, check out our sister show, The X-Cast, and X-Files podcast, where you can find our Patreon. This is who we are.